So glad you're here. Come on in. This is the Reasonable Faith Podcast with Dr. William Lane Craig. I'm Kevin Harris, and as we get started today, let me tell you about something new. The new Reasonable Faith app for iPhone and iPod Touch or iPad is here, and you can go to our web community at reasonablefaith.org and get it right there. Reasonablefaith.org, the new Reasonable Faith app. Several questions we want to talk about today that listeners have sent us. This one, Bill, is on the resurrection. Dear Dr. Craig, my question is on the term resurrection in 1 Corinthians 15. The word for raised is egero, which means to wake up or come to. Paul did not use the word for resurrection, anastasis or anastemi, here, though he certainly knew it. Is there a conflict with Paul using the word egero rather than anastasis or anastemi?
No, not at all. Greek had two words that could be used interchangeably to connote the raising of the dead. The one has the sense of to get up or stand up or to raise up, and the other had the idea of to wake up. The dead are thought to be sleeping in the tombs, and they would wake up. And either of these are terms for the resurrection. Interestingly enough, both of them pass into German. Kevin, if you read German theology, they talk in equal terms about either the Auferstehung of Jesus, which is literally the sort of standing up of Jesus, the Auferstehung, or the Auferweckung, the waking up of Jesus. The Auferweckung is the waking. So these terms are used synonymously in Greek, and they're used synonymously in modern theology in German. In English, we just have the single word raised. But in Greek, there's no problem. Now, I think where the questioner errs is by saying that these words cannot be used in a different context to mean something else. That's certainly true. In a different context, they could be just as English words can. I can say, he raised a question at the meeting. Does that mean he lifted the question up above his head or something? Obviously not. Words can be used to different meanings. But if I say Jesus was raised from the dead, there I'm using it in that context to talk about what happened to his body. So context is everything. You cannot use the etymology of words independently of context as a hermeneutical tool. You always have to look at the context. And obviously in 1 Corinthians 15, the sequence of events, he died, he was buried, he was raised, he appeared, is clearly talking about the resurrection of Jesus. And by the way, Kevin, no New Testament scholar denies this. The two people that he quotes in this question that you're asking me about, which I've seen, are not Greek specialists or linguists. They're just internet infidel types who are not experts in this area.
Okay. There's a reason I'm asking this simple question that we got here, Bill, and I think you'll pick up on it. And again, bring forth some definitions that are necessary in communicating today. He asks, are you a creationist? By your affiliates, you seem to be so.
Oh, by my affiliates? You know, this is this McCarthyism again that I've spoken of in other contexts, where if you affiliate with some young earth creationist, he's your friend or colleague, then you are too.
Well, now see, that's the issue, Bill. If you believe in a creator, are you a creationist?
Well, he says because of my affiliates,
yeah.
Kevin, and I certainly do have colleagues who are young earthers and friends who are, but that doesn't make me one. Now, in terms of being a creationist, I'm a creationist in the loose and broad sense that I believe that God created the universe ex nihilo, that is to say, without any material cause. I think that God created space, time, matter, and energy, and so in that sense, I'm a creationist. But I'm not what passes in today's parlance as a young earth creationist who thinks the world was made 10 to 20,000 years ago. And you can't judge a person by his affiliates.
Well, true. But when you say creationist today, what it means?
Well, I think it tends to mean young earth creationist.
That's what it means. That's what it has come to mean.
Right.
For better or for worse, whether we can help it or not, it's one of those things.
Right.
So if someone were to come to me and say, are you a creationist? My first response would be to say, well, what do you mean? You know, Dear Dr. Craig, in Theism, Atheism, and Big Bang Cosmology, your rebuttal to an infinite amount of past events included an analogy to the infinite library, where there exists a one-to-one correspondence between all numbers and all books. If so, there you cannot add a book to this set because it is already infinitely full. However, in response to this, aren't you supposing that an infinite reality would act like a finite reality, such that a fullness, infinitude, would be the same as a fullness in infinitude? In other words, what if there is no fullness in an infinite reality, and thus more events can be added to the existing infinite set of past events?
I think that this question is based on a misunderstanding. I don't recall that I ever used the word full or fullness in connection with the library. I'm not arguing that the reason you couldn't add to the library is because the shelves were full, if that's what he thinks. I never said that. You could build more shelves, right? That's not a problem. Build more shelves. The reason I said was that all the numbers have been used up, and so there aren't any more numbers to add. That's all the numbers there are, the natural numbers, to number these objects. And so you'd have to have a new natural number, and there is no such thing. So that was the argument I was attempting to offer.
Okay, so fullness doesn't really come into the picture then?
No, not in this illustration.
Okay. From California, Dr. Craig, can the Kalam cosmological argument be extended and effectively applied to the hypothetical metaverse, with the second premise being the metaverse or multiverse began to exist, showing that if a part of the metaverse, namely the universe, began to exist, then an array of multiple invisible universes or multiverse, by virtue of the second law of thermodynamics, began to exist?
Well, if you read my work, Kevin, you'll know that when I use the word universe in that second premise, I'm talking about all space-time reality, including any other universes that might be thought to exist alongside of ours in a sort of expanding vacuum space. And so I regularly deal with multiverse theories in the defense of premise two, that the universe began to exist. So yes, I don't think of it as an extension, because when I use the word universe, I mean all space-time reality. But certainly the philosophical arguments apply to any wider multiverse that one might imagine, and even the empirical arguments would apply. The Bohr-Guth-Vilenkin theorem applies not simply to our bubble universe, but it applies to the expanding false vacuum in which our universe is thought to exist. It also must have a beginning. So yes, the arguments do apply to any multiverse that one might want to hypothesize.
Here's an interesting question, Bill. I don't think we've ever discussed this on the podcast. Dear Dr. Craig, do you believe in the possibility of ghosts? This is something that many people have claimed to have seen or experienced. One of the reasons I want to bring it up, Bill, is that this is everywhere. Ghost Hunters is a huge show on the Sci-Fi Channel. The Travel Channel has a Ghost Hunters thing, and they do capture some pretty weird things. Nothing ever conclusive, but
I guess that would depend on what a person means by a ghost. If you mean by a ghost some departed or dead individual, I guess I don't believe in ghosts, because even though I believe in disembodied souls after death, it seems to me that those souls are either in paradise with Christ in the case of the righteous dead, or they're confined in Hades, the place of the unrighteous dead, where they await the final resurrection, and therefore they are not haunting earthly habitats. On the other hand, I do believe in such a thing as demonic beings, and if ghosts are demons who impersonate people, then I don't have any reason to think that that isn't possible.
Dear Dr. Craig, is it a category error to say that a happy and blessed existence in God's kingdom is better than no existence, or that an existence of misery in hell is worse than no existence? I've been told that this is a category error, because if A didn't exist, he could be none the better or worse. I can't put my finger on it, but something seems wrong with this logic to me.
Right. This comes out in the ontological argument as Anselm originally developed it. He said a being is greater if it exists than if it doesn't exist. Now, at one level, that seems obviously right. Something that exists is greater than if it doesn't exist. And yet, on the other hand, you can't say, well, you can't make a comparison between something that exists and something that doesn't exist, because if something doesn't exist, there's nothing to compare it to, right? There's just nothing. But I think that we can make sense of this in a way that wouldn't require us to refer to non-existent objects. I think what we could say for some existing person, that it's better for me, referring to me, that I exist than if I hadn't existed. And that seems to be intuitively right. We're not making a comparison between an existent and a non-existent being. We're talking about an existent being, me, and we're saying I'm better off existing than if I hadn't existed. Because if I hadn't existed, I wouldn't have had any value, right? Because there wouldn't be any person at all. And similarly, a person in hell, I think you could say, is worse off than if he hadn't existed, in the sense that the person in hell is miserable, whereas if he hadn't existed, he wouldn't be miserable, right?
Right.
So put it in these counterfactual terms, that a person's state is better than if he hadn't either existed or been in this other state.
And you've discussed in past podcasts that the possibility that people, or the actuality that people will tragically end up in hell, does not have veto power over God's desire to create and his purposes for creating.
Right, right. They're there of their own volition. They've rejected and spurned God's grace, and so have no one but themselves to blame for their state, their miserable state.
Okay, and once again, go to reasonablefaith.org and get that new app for your iPhone, your iPod Touch, or your iPad at reasonablefaith.org, and we'll see you next time.